Hello, this is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315. Today's interview is with Christian philosopher Wynn Corduan. Dr. Corduan has served as a professor or adjunct professor of philosophy and religion at numerous colleges, universities, and seminaries. He's also served as president of both the International Society of Christian Apologetics and the Evangelical Philosophical Society. Dr. Corduan is an accomplished writer, having written numerous academic journal articles as well as 11 books. His books include Neighboring Faiths, A Christian Introduction to World Religions, No Doubt About It, The Case for Christianity, Pocket Guide to World Religions, Handmade to Theology, An Essay in Philosophical Prolegomena, Reasonable Faith, Basic Christian Apologetics, and a number of others. The purpose of our interview today is to talk about apologetics, the role of philosophy in apologetics, more about Wynn's area of expertise, and his advice for those defending the faith. Well, thanks for joining me today for the interview, Dr. Corduan.
Hi, Brian. It's good to be with you. It's an honor and a privilege, really, to be on your blog and to be able to talk to you like this.
Well, thank you. Before we get started, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what your areas of work and interest are?
Sure. Well, you got to know that I was born in Germany, and that's why I sound the way that I do. I came to the United States when I was 13 years old because my father was transferred here for a time to the U.S. I went to the University of Maryland and studied zoology there. Then I went to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and got my M.A. in philosophy of religion, and then my Ph.D. from Rice in religious studies. I did my dissertation on the philosophical presuppositions that Karl Rahner, the Catholic theologian, was using, particularly focusing on his similarities to Hegel. I taught at Taylor University for 31 years. When I came there, I had a very strange assignment. They wanted someone who could teach New Testament survey, world religions, and various philosophy courses. So I started out with a pretty broad set of assignments. Mm-hmm. And world religions was the one course that I was the weakest in. Okay, I had some of that in grad school. So that's the one that I worked on the most. And for a long time, my writings were all basically in philosophy of religion and philosophical theology and that kind of thing. But the mountain of information in world religions really grew. And so I eventually wound up writing Neighboring Faiths and then a number of other books in that area. And so for quite a while now, world religions really has been my most specialized area of concentration. Not that I've dropped all of the other aspects of apologetics or philosophy, but that's really been my focal point now.
Was it your interest in that subject and your study in that subject that started to get you into the field of apologetics? And what exactly got you doing apologetics, if you will?
Well, just out of sentimentality, I'm holding it in my hand right now, a copy of Paul Little's Know Why You Believe, which came out in, 1967. I was active in InterVarsity, and we were playing some game or something, and I won a copy of this book. And at the time, I was a sophomore, as I said, majoring in zoology. I was a Christian. And I picked up this book, and then I started to read it. And on the very first page, the late Paul Little talks about people who for the first time realize that there is some rationality to the gospel. To quote, unbelievers say the session has been helpful because it's the first time they've heard something that makes sense. I'm also gratified but more deeply dismayed when Christians tell me the same thing. they're relieved to discover that the gospel can be successfully defended in the open marketplace of ideas, and to discover they haven't kissed their brains goodbye in becoming Christians. Now, I would have been one of those people. That was a real revelation to me. And so I really got intrigued. And right around that time, then Francis Schaeffer's books came out. Clark Pinnock's book, Set Forth Your Case, came out. At the time, he was this very strong, energetic, reformed apologist. And so it's really reading those books that got me interested in it, and that's why eventually from my bachelor's degree in zoology, I went to seminary and got my MA in philosophy of religion.
Well, very good. You know, I wonder how many people Paul Little's book has affected in a similar way. It's just a powerful testimony of the impact just a book like that can make years and years down the road. It's excellent. You mentioned how you got into philosophy of religion. And along that note, some people are maybe turned off by philosophy, and they would say that it's really something that is somehow going to interfere with their theology in some way. Maybe that side of the spectrum is the no to philosophy group. But on the other end, you have those who think philosophy is actually the best thing, and if you don't get into it, then you're not going to be a good thinker or a theologian somehow. So where do you think we should try to place ourselves between those two extremes on the spectrum, if you will?
Well, there's an easy answer to that question, and then if I may, let me reframe things a little bit. The easy answer is, if you're good at philosophy, do it. If you're not, please stay away from it. We don't need anybody doing mediocre philosophy against their inclinations. I think I'm noticing a little bit too much of a connection in your question between philosophy and apologetics. I think sometimes we bring the two too close together. Mm-hmm. So let me just give you a really big picture, if I may. And, you know, we begin with the gospel of Jesus Christ as a historical event, and that historical event leads to a personal event, our conversion, regeneration, faith in him. And this is a supernatural event that comes to us by God's grace. Now, our duty as Christians is to share the gospel with other people, to do evangelism, by which I don't mean necessarily persuading people, because that's the job of the Holy Spirit, but making sure that we tell people the gospel in such a way that they're able to make a decision one way or the other. Now, there are going to be certain barriers that oftentimes come up between people accepting the gospel and or even listening to us telling it or not. And they can come in many different forms, as we know. Some people are hungry. They're starving. They don't have time to listen to the gospel. So we come to them with food to build a bridge. Some people have medical problems, and unless we address them first, we'll never get them to listen to what we're saying about the love of God. Okay, now, for some people, there are intellectual barriers, and they can be in many different areas. In the area of the truth of the Bible, in history, in personal experience, in philosophical areas such as the problem of evil or arguments for the existence of God and so forth. And that last little part is what we call apologetics. And that is to remove the intellectual barriers so that people can commit themselves to Jesus Christ. Okay, and that's going to involve philosophy, but it's going to involve many, many other areas as well. So for some people, such as me, philosophy became the gateway to apologetics, but we need just as badly biblical scholars like B.B. Warfield and Gleason Archer are two people who come to mind who can continue that side of apologetics. Let me give you one other quick example of what I'm saying. For the last few years when I taught at Taylor, and I'm retired on disability from there now, but for the last few years when I taught apologetics, it was a general education course, so everyone, regardless of the major, had to take it. And on the first day, you know, I would have a class of 50 or 60 students, and I'd have them divide into groups of three or four. And then each group, and I kept it in groups so it would be semi-anonymous, each group had to come up with two, three, four real-life answers to filling in what somebody might say to complete the sentence, I could believe that Christianity is true if... Okay, what are you going to put in there? I could believe that Christianity is true if, well, if my grandma hadn't died, or if Jesus showed himself to me right now, or if I could get past the second premise of the Kalam argument, probably not as likely, but if I had good reason to believe that there is a God, could fit in there. Or if I could believe in the supernatural, and on and on and on. Now, there's a lot of answers that, or a lot of fill-ins there that you wind up having to throw out. People making unreasonable demands. But when you throw out the chaff and look at the genuine, sincere answers, there you have your course in apologetics. There you have, and you know, it's really interesting, as my colleague Jim Spiegel, who wrote the book on hypocrisy, says, that's one of the most common arguments used against Christianity. And yet, there aren't very many apologetics books that even talk about that.
That's a great point.
To come back to the original question, apologetics doesn't have to be philosophy. Philosophy is not necessarily the way of doing apologetics. But, you know, I'm not talking myself out of a job. I'm just saying we need to be careful not to overemphasize the philosophical side of apologetics to the detriment of all of the other components that go into it.
Well, I think that's very good advice. Now, speaking as a philosopher then, after that excellent introduction, what role do you think that philosophy does play? What, in that sense, what is the appropriate role for philosophy in defending the faith?
Well, there are intellectual questions and genuine philosophical questions. And the problem of evil, for example, comes down to philosophical question. Now, there's an existential side to it. You know, why is God doing this to me? I don't know. Let's pray about it. But then again, it's next to the hypocrisy argument, one of the most common ones. I could believe in the truth of Christianity if there wasn't so much evil in the world. And implicit in that objection is the inconsistency between the God of Christianity and the reality of evil. So that's a philosophical question. Whether there is evidence for the existence of God is a philosophical question. Whether there is truth and how we can get to it, that's a philosophical matter. So if apologetics assists evangelism, then philosophy is one of the major assistants for apologetics.
Can you talk about the area of philosophical theology and what that is?
you can call a lot of things philosophical theology. Let me give you two ways of looking at the term. One would be roughly equivalent, I would think, with a natural theology, which is a theology that you build on general revelation alone. Whatever it is that God has built into the world that is just there, it's a given for anyone to see. Romans 1 talks about his sovereignty, his greatness, and so forth. And you can see that in creation. You can see that people have a moral sense of some sort, and so forth. And so you take this general revelation and you build a natural theology on it that doesn't take special revelation into account, doesn't rely on the Bible or mystical experiences or things like that. And I guess that would be philosophical theology. Now, there's another way of looking at it, and of course the two aren't totally dichotomous, but the other way of looking at it would be to say that philosophical theology looks at the categories that a theologian by necessity needs to use in order to express his systematic theology coherently. I mean, here's the thing. Anytime that I say something, quote, theological, which can be anything from explaining my view of divine election to God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. You know, anytime that I make a theological, quote, assertion, I'm really combining the content of Scripture with my own conceptual world. I'm bringing together the conceptual frame that I live with, my own philosophy, whatever that may be. For a lot of us, it's pretty pragmatic, or it could be very idealist or whatever. And so you could also think of philosophical theology in terms of the philosophical framework without which we really can't do a coherent biblical or systematic theology that speaks to our culture today.
Well, here's another philosophy question right along that same line. Mm-hmm. Talking about philosophy of religion, can you talk about, in general, how this connects with your study of comparative religions and how that fits into that?
We have a longstanding tradition now in modern philosophy, maybe even medieval philosophy, where the division wasn't as stark, where philosophy of religion becomes one of the subcategories of philosophy, and it's where we deal with questions of God, freedom, the soul, and immortality, to hitch on Kant a little bit, and standard issues that we deal with over and over again. We've established certain categories, traditionally divide various perspectives into worldviews, theism, deism, polytheism, pantheism, panentheism, and so forth. When we look at other religions, oftentimes they deal with very similar questions. Now, you know, there are these stereotype views of the religions, and we can talk about that some more, but what I'm thinking here particularly now is of the various philosophical schools of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism, and so forth. And they deal with many of the same questions, but their worldviews do not fit any of our preconceived or traditional categories. You know, there's a real misunderstanding going around, for example, concerning pantheism. You know, many people believe that all Eastern thought is pantheistic. The reality is that a minority of Hindus hold to some form of pantheism. Buddhism is not pantheistic at all. There is no Buddhism in any, at least authentic Asian-based mm-hmm. Buddhism. So what is Buddhism? Well, I don't know. Buddhism is Buddhism, and you can, it doesn't fit our Western categories. It's a lot like nihilism, but not quite, and so forth. And so there's another whole world, and it's a big one, that we need to study if we want to communicate. And so we've been doing well with Western philosophy of religion. We've done horribly with Eastern philosophy of religion. And since it is making inroads into our culture increasingly, I think we need to work on that and learn what Buddhist philosophies and Hindu philosophies and so forth are if we want to engage on the most fundamental level of the philosophical marketplace there.
Well, Dr. Cordovan, you mentioned earlier how, you know, you began your studies in looking at world religions, and I know that just recently you were doing some travel and you were studying Buddhism and even exploring that even further. So I wonder what particular areas most attract your own study and what motivates you to go down a different path of study, say, in Buddhism. Is it your interest in that topic, or are there certain elements within that area that you want to explore?
As late as in my PhD program, about the last thing in the world I was interested in was comparative religion and world religions and so forth. And my chairman forced me into it and to take some seminars and so forth. And then, as I said, that wound up paying off and getting the job at Taylor and then working on the various aspects of world religions and coming across a lot of questions that I couldn't find answers for that I could give to my students. So I wound up learning some of the languages and so forth. And out of that knowledge and that ability, then a lot of opportunities for ministry have arisen. Specifically, at this point, let me talk about Buddhism. That would not have been necessarily my number one focus, as it has been over the last few years. But it's part of preparing for a website that is hopefully going to be open by the end of this year or early next year in January or so, in which we engage with Buddhists and Christians who want to know more about Buddhism and clarify the differences, and ultimately, as I was saying earlier, remove barriers so that people can see the gospel clearly and respond to it. For about 10 years now, I've been part of a group of people that's been working on a site for Hindus along that line. And I can't give you the name of either one at this point because believers in India might be in jeopardy if I make specifics public at this point. But we've had some remarkable results because of such a website relating to Hindus. And so about 5 years ago, my friend and I came up with the idea of doing the same thing for Buddhism. Now, that's like going from a bicycle to General Motors. And Hinduism is complex, but Buddhism is unbelievably complex because it's adaptable, and it does adapt itself. And in every geographic region, Buddhism is different. And and if we want to run this site with credibility, then we need to have had firsthand experience with Buddhism in various locations. And the kicker is that there are no such sites on the web. There is no general site that is oriented towards reaching Buddhists. Not in the English language, not in Mandarin, not in Pali, or whatever. And so we've been working very hard to prepare for that. And this was the second of two such trips that we've done. One was 2 years ago, where we went to Taiwan and visited a lot of Mahayana temples. And this one was primarily Thailand, to get some more first-hand exposure to Theravada Buddhism. Now, it's not that I haven't had exposure to both of them, but these were specifically geared to be study trips. And they really were. I mean, they were not just vacations with a little bit of Buddhism thrown in. In those temperatures, you don't go out and visit a temple for fun. And, you know, we would stay in a temple, take pictures, find people to talk to, and come back with just a mountain and mountain of information, you know, which I'm slowly compiling on my blog. And got another, who knows, 10 entries to go or so, just for the summary.
Well, you have written a number of books, you know, the different areas of theology, apologetics, and philosophy of religion. I wonder if you could only recommend one or two of those works, which you'd want to recommend and why. Maybe one that stands out as maybe a signature book of yours, or one that's really made an impact on you personally.
I think the book that's become associated with me most is probably the survey of world religions that's called Neighboring Faiths. And that's coming out in a second edition, finally, from InterVarsity Press. So that would be the number one book that would be associated with me, I think. And then the other one that I would want to recommend is my apologetics text that I wrote for a, you know, for the audience that I talked about earlier, an audience of a class of students that's not philosophy majors, but that's business majors, elementary ed majors, Bible majors, some philosophy majors, and so forth. Unfortunately, it goes by the rather misleading title of No Doubt About It, which I didn't have a choice in, but of course there's a lot of doubt about it, or we wouldn't need to do apologetics. But So I think those are the two books that should probably go on my tombstone, as it were. I have special affinity for a couple of others. One is my very first one, Handmade to Theology, which is exploring what I was talking about a little while ago, the philosophical presuppositions that are necessary to do a coherent Christian theology, that came out way back in 81 and has been picked up by Wiffenstock. And the other one would be my commentary on 1st and 2nd Chronicles, which is in the Holman Old Testament Commentary Series. And obviously I love that because it's totally different from anything else.
Uh-huh.
And I really enjoy doing it. And the editor said afterwards, you've really made Chronicles come alive, which many people would doubt is even possible, and I'm not sure it is, but I've given it a good stab. And so that book has a particular special place in my heart.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, you've written these different books on world religion, survey of world religions. You've also contributed the Pocket Guide of World Religions. So I'm wondering, and you've kind of talked about Buddhism and Hinduism, but the question I have is, the particular religions that you feel have been neglected as far as needing to be answered or addressed from a Christian view, sometimes I think of, say, the rise of Islam and whether or not more attention should be given to apologetics work dealing with Islam. You've mentioned Buddhism and Hinduism. Would those be the main ones that you think more focus needs to be put on?
I think it would help if people got more information on Hinduism and got away from trying to understand all of Hinduism as pantheism and so forth. But the big one is Buddhism, because people don't even see it. As I was saying earlier, most people that I know of still think of Buddhism as a kind of pantheism. You know, the standard joke, the Zen Buddhist says to the hot dog vendor, make me one with everything. I mean, you know, that has nothing whatsoever to do with Buddhism. Now, this is a complicated thing in terms of the origin of it, because a number of the popularizers of Buddhism in Western culture, such as Christmas Humphreys and Ellen Watts, liberally traded information between Hinduism and Buddhism as well, and really gave a character of it. So, for example, my friend David Clark's book, The Pantheism of Ellen Watts, is right on target, but Ellen Watts doesn't really represent Buddhism in its pure sense. So Buddhism is being taught in all our major universities, frequently out of the philosophy departments, under the understanding that it's a philosophy and not a religion. Buddhism is extremely adaptable. I mean, when I'm saying that Buddhism is invading, quote, close quote, the Western culture, I'm not thinking in terms of men in orange robes chanting, but I'm talking about a new philosophy that's not all that different from Christianity, that accommodates Christianity, but that ultimately leads in the wrong direction. Let me give you an anecdote to illustrate the kind of thing that I'm thinking of here. When we were in Taiwan 2 years ago, there was an education professor from a university in Taiwan who drove us to the various temples and had made arrangement for us to meet with the various monks and nuns and so forth, who put in a lot of work for us to do that. She was a Buddhist, and we asked her why she was doing all of that. And her answer was, I too love the Lord, by which she meant Jesus. And when we asked her a little bit more about how she understood Jesus, she said, basically, that she saw Jesus as one of the great bodhisattvas. A bodhisattva is a Buddha in the making. And according to Mahayana Buddha, any person can become a Buddha. And Jesus is one of the great bodhisattvas in her view, and he showed his great love and compassion for us by dying on the cross and rising from the dead. And so she too, as a Buddhist, believes in Jesus. Okay, hold on. Half an hour later, part of what we do on these trips is to try to establish relationships with Christian believers who have come out of the particular religion, in this case, Buddhism. And we're speaking to a couple who have been Christians for a few years now, who came out of Buddhism. And I pushed them a little bit on their understanding of Christianity and of the gospel. And basically, what I got was almost verbatim the same thing. Well, we see Jesus as the greatest of the bodhisattvas. And he showed God's love to us by dying on the cross for us. And if we believe in him and try our hardest, then ultimately we will be able to get out of the cycle of reincarnation. That's the kind of thinking that I'm thinking of. That's the kind of doctrine that is Buddhist and yet can accommodate itself so smoothly to Christianity, we hardly even notice it. That's why I'm saying we need to become aware of what Buddhism really is. We need to take the trouble and do the work. We need scholars who will read the original writings and, you know, same kind of thing that we've done in other areas. It's not going to be easy. But if we want to do apologetics with Eastern religions in mind, we have a gigantic project ahead of us. And I'm not saying don't study the traditional categories, the traditional academic disciplines, but we need to be prepared to encounter those thought patterns as well, because particularly in terms of Buddhism, as I said, it can, and I don't mean to use such negative language because they mean well, but it can infiltrate the way that we think, and if we're not prepared, we don't even realize how far what these people are saying may be from what we believe Christianity is.
Well, that's good, and I think my follow-up question is sort of a combination of what you had talked about earlier and what you've just answered there, and that's basically, what areas of study do you think can be most beneficial to contributing if one doesn't just study general apologetics and they want to do scholarly work in an area that will be of benefit apologetically? What do you think are the most helpful areas? Maybe this could be called the scholarly underpinning. You mentioned how philosophy is not the only area to study, and then you're mentioning now Buddhism and Hinduism that are areas, say, that haven't even hardly been tapped. Talk about what your thoughts are in those areas.
What we really need is scholars, any field really, whether it's botany or English literature, medieval literature, philosophy, certainly, biblical studies, but we desperately, I think, need to continue the tradition that started around the end of the 19th century of solid Christian scholarship. And I'm afraid, to be really honest about it, that the current excitement about apologetics, which obviously I think is wonderful, also has a liability in it, namely that we study apologetics as though it were a discipline in itself. That means we're going to have nothing but secondhand answers or we're going to run out of answers unless we continue to really encourage people to become scholars in various areas and learn how to exhibit the truth of God's revelation in those particular areas. And that includes sciences, the humanities, how badly, how desperately we need Christians in the social sciences. But, you know, it's almost impossible for Christians to survive in those academic areas anymore. But we need Christians in those areas to show God's truth there. So my answer to your question, I guess, is anything, but please study something thoroughly.
What about those people who are currently active in doing apologetics work of some sort? Maybe they're active in their church or they have some sort of campus outreach. What kind of advice would you have for them just to be better at doing that ministry area that God has them in right now?
Okay, good question. Thank you. And that gets me off that other hobby horse, and that's good. Number one, I mean, they're not going to go back to graduate school and get a PhD in something. I assume you're including that in your question. So what should they do? Well, first of all, don't lose sight of the purpose of apologetics, the thing that I was talking about earlier, that the bottom line is contributing to evangelism, or let's add one other thing, to strengthening the faith of believers who may be wrestling with doubt. Okay, but don't lose sight of the fact that apologetics is not an end in itself. I don't know, am I going too far if I say that in some Christian circles, apologetics is almost becoming a form of Christian entertainment? You know, let's have a debate and let's have so-and-so demolish so-and-so. And that's going to bring a lot of people to church. And, you know, that's not what apologetics should be about. And that's not a very good Christian attitude. But I think for some people, it's kind of becoming that. Okay, so first of all, don't lose sight of the purpose of apologetics. And then second, just don't stop learning. You know, what happens to all of us, hopefully, is that we go on learning. And for me, that means constantly revising, getting more accurate, more precise, realizing that something I've said for 20 years is either wrong or at least misleading and so forth. And I suspect if that's true for me, it could be true for someone who is working on a more popular level, as like a college campus ministry or something like that. There are new books coming out all the time. I worked in a Christian bookstore when I was an undergraduate, and I have to qualify here, a real Christian bookstore. It had books.
Oh, good. No Jesus Frisbees?
No Jesus Frisbees. We had a shelf of doodads and everything else. Everything else was books. And my manager at the store used to say, you can tell when a person's mind died by looking at the copyright dates of the books on his shelves at home. You know, if the latest copyright date is 2003, so his saying was, well, apparently in 2003 your mind died, you stopped reading, you stopped growing. Okay, now that may be Well, it is a tenuit. It's a little bit overstated, but I think there's also a lot of truth in it. And it's very easy to keep going with the same answers that we learned 10 years ago, 20 years ago, who knows. But we need to let ourselves be challenged, and we need to learn where there are more answers, better answers, other answers, and so forth, and never stop our minds from continuing to love the Lord as much as our hearts do.
One of the things you mentioned there is about the importance of learning in depth as opposed to just having pat answers for people. So I wondered, as we start to wrap up here, what sort of particular study skills or disciplines that you found beneficial would you want to impart to others to help them to be better thinkers, better learners, better scholars?
It's important that we do not give up on reading. And we're becoming very, very dependent on videos and these kinds of broadcasts and so forth. But reading still does something that listening and speaking does not do. Writing is, of course, the flip side of that, it challenges our capacities for logical thinking, and it helps us grow in logical thinking, clear thinking, much more than for most people, at least, some of the other skills do, like listening and speaking. I mean, they're good and they're helpful, but there's nothing like engaging with an argument on paper, and it's going to take more than 30 seconds.
Yeah.
But wrestling with it. And the other thing that I would want to underscore, and again, I'm not sure if that's what you're after, is remember that at the heart of it all is the gospel of Jesus Christ as revealed in Scripture. And don't get so taken up by apologetics that you do not maintain your consistent time with the Lord in His Word and prayer and whatever other gifts He has provided for us to exercise or to benefit from. Apologetics is one small part of the work of the church and of the life of the believer. And so your total walk with Christ should not get swallowed up by apologetics. Your apologetics will no doubt be enhanced by also studying, worshiping, reading, and so forth in areas that are not apologetics oriented.
Well, that's very good advice, and I think an excellent note to conclude on. Dr. Corcoran, is there a place online where you'd like to direct our listeners if they want to find more information by yourself?
Well, you can go to one of two sites. One is my main website, which is at www.wincorcoran.com, just one word. And the other is my blog. I try to keep up theoretically every day, but it doesn't even come close to that. And that is at wincorcoran.bravejournal.com.
Well, very good. Dr. Corcoran, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and thanks for taking the time to do the interview.
Well, thank you. It's been enjoyable, and I trust it's been helpful. I sure appreciate you talking to me.
I've been speaking with Christian philosopher Win Corduan, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and Religion, Taylor University, Indiana. Links to his books and resources can be found at today's blog post at Apologetics 315. This podcast marks around 100 interviews with Christian apologists, scholars, theologians, philosophers, authors, and other defenders of the faith. Do you have a recommendation for someone you'd like to hear interviewed? Perhaps suggestions on how to make this podcast better? Feel free to email your recommendations to interviews@apologetics315.com. And there are other podcasts by Apologetics 315 found in iTunes. You can search for them within iTunes, and they include How to Get Apologetics in Your Church, Is Christianity True?, Logical Fallacies 1 and Logical Fallacies 2, Fallacy Friday, Read Along with Apologetics 315, Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology Lectures, and this podcast, Apologetics 315 Interviews. One thing that helps get the word out about resources like this interview is your help by sending links, tweets, and Facebook updates to your friends on the web. So if you found this resource helpful, please take a few seconds to share it. I also encourage you to be a friend on Facebook or Twitter for more daily links to the best resources and articles in Christian apologetics. Please do pray for this ministry as it continues to grow, and if it's been a blessing to you, let us know and send us an email. This is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315, and thanks for listening.